Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and our technical director, Henry Frain, at the controls. American rhetoric refers to the occupation of Iraq as a front line in the war on terror. But what does the occupation mean to the people of Iraq? Beyond the voices of official spokespersons, we rarely hear the voices of ordinary Iraqi people most affected by the latest nightmare on the ground. Which is why the latest book by our guest in this hour, Anthony Shadid, is so compelling. Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, draws from Mr. Shadid's reporting for The Washington Post, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in 2004. It presents a ground-level and very personal view of Iraq, as seen by Iraqis from many different walks of life. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk with Anthony Shadid about the stories in the book and about the ongoing occupation and conflict in Iraq. Anthony Shadid is the Islamic Affairs correspondent for The Washington Post and has reported from Iraq since well before the U.S.-led war in 2003. He is the only reporter so far to win the Pulitzer for his coverage of Iraq, and he is one of a very few U.S. reporters to speak Arabic. He reported for the Associated Press and the Boston Globe prior to joining the staff at The Washington Post, and he has reported from Egypt, Lebanon, Iraq, the Persian Gulf, Europe, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Israel, and Palestine. He was awarded a citation from the Overseas Press Club for his series Islam's Challenge, which formed the core of his first book, Legacy of the Prophet: Despots, Democrats, and the New Politics of Islam. The book we'll draw from today, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, was recently published by Henry Holt. As we talk with Anthony Shadid, we welcome your questions. You can join us by telephone, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening on the Internet, anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. And Anthony Shadid joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's a great book.
Thank you.
It's definitely a very powerful book. I want to ask just to start out with, you know, Americans have read a lot about Iraq, hopefully, over the past few years, but Night Draws Near seems to be an entirely different kind of reporting. You aren't embedded, as the saying goes. You're not focusing on official political pronouncements, per se, or the daily drumbeat of bombings. But instead, you provide a view of these events through the eyes of ordinary people.
You know, it wasn't my ambition going into this to do it that way, to be perfectly honest. I had been in Baghdad a couple of times, like you mentioned earlier, with the AP and the Boston Globe. And then I arrived in Baghdad itself in March of 2003, a few weeks before the invasion. You know, and I was there as any other reporter would be. I was trying to see what, there's one place where the bombs are dropped, and there's one place where the bombs landed. I wanted to see where the bombs landed. And a few days into the war, you know, I got advice from my editors, which a couple of pieces of advice, and it almost might sound kind of mundane at this point, but one editor said, listen, you're there, and you should try to define the story. The other editor had picked up on some of the stuff that I was writing. He said, you know, it's really remarkable what people are talking about, what people are saying, and you should make a real effort to, like, try to capture those sentiments, try to capture those perspectives, and, you know, perhaps shed light on these greater issues going on, these issues of religion, of war, of occupation, of siege. Try to capture those larger issues through the eyes of the people themselves. And I started doing that during the war, during the invasion. I sometimes mix up those two terms, but during the invasion. And, you know, it became in the end, it's what I kind of shaped my reporting almost exclusively. And the people I met during the war, families and individuals, I stayed with them through the aftermath. And I tried to understand the occupation, tried to understand how these two political cultures intersect in a way through their experiences. And, you know, it was a different perspective, I think, often.
Well, and also, you got to see how people's views evolved as time went on.
Exactly. And I think it's the most powerful thing we can do as reporters, is that kind of retrospective or that perspective over time. I mean, we're so used to writing an 800-word story, a 900-word story off one interview, and sometimes that's illuminating. I mean, I think it can be very powerful at times. But what I've struck, and what I've had the chance to do in Iraq, is to talk to people over a year or a year and a half, and to see how those perspectives change, how those sentiments change, and they often change dramatically. And those changes, it's less what they're saying, and perhaps more what's changing about what they're saying that tells us the most about what's going on.
It strikes me over and over while reading your book how different our view is from those of the people in Iraq. Americans seem to have this snapshot view of Iraq under the tyrant Saddam Hussein. But the Iraqi view extends from their suffering in recent years under Saddam back thousands of years of history. And much of that history was of Baghdad as really the greatest city in the world.
Anyways, and it's a powerful memory. It's, you know, I've always been struck that Baghdad, I mean, I think especially to Arabs, even to Arab Americans, Baghdad is, you know, often it's more an idea than a reality. I mean, there is the city of Baghdad today, which is a city, is somewhat ordinary in a lot of ways. It's less ordinary these days because it's dominated by concrete and barbed wire. But, you know, I think what more powerful to most people is what the word suggests. And the word does suggest, like you said, this incredible history, a history that stretches back hundreds of years, of centuries, and, you know, and marked a certain moment of civilization. It was this flowering of culture, a flowering of ideas, a self-confidence of culture that's not all that apparent these days, I think, in the Arab world. And, you know, when Baghdad was wrecked, I think in the looting and in the lawlessness that followed Saddam's fall, it was a painful moment for a lot of Baghdadis. They were watching not what would happen to any city in Iraq, but they were watching, you know, in a way kind of the smearing of an idea, you know, a tarnishing of an idea. Baghdad was an idea, and here this was its fate. And it was a very kind of bleak fate.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is probably the part of the interview where we talk about how bad Saddam was, and probably the most salient ground we could cover is how great things were actually going in Iraq in the 1970s before he basically ruined everything.
Exactly, and I think that, you know, when we talk about this kind of distant past, when Baghdad was the center of the world in a lot of ways, there was very, very pale imitation, but there was a certain exuberance that kind of mimicked that in the 1970s when oil prices skyrocketed and revenue just started pouring into the country. In the 1970s, Iraq had, I forget the exact comparison, but it was a GDP or a living standard close to some of the poorer countries in Europe. There was reform going on. There was a growing middle class. There was a flowering of culture, of education. Intellectuals from the rest of the Arab world would come to Iraq to, one, to have a great time, and then two, also there was a kind of an exchange of ideas, especially as Beirut, which had traditionally been kind of the cosmopolitan center of the Arab world, was, you know, torn by civil war. You know, Baghdad emerges as another capital, as another cultural capital, and, you know, of course that was followed, you know, at the end of the decade marked the final ascent of Saddam.
So a lot of the people that you spoke with did, you know, they were alive in the 70s. They remember these times and sort of, you know, perhaps their hopes were suppressed, to say the least, under Saddam. But they still had that idea of what a great place Baghdad could be, what Iraq could be. And so at least they had that aspiration or expectation that if things could change, then that could be the case again.
You know, and that's a good point to, like, you know, to kind of understand how people think today. I mean, I've struck so often in the conversations. I remember, a Shiite psychiatrist that I became close to during the invasion and then stayed in touch with in the aftermath. You know, Americans would often, I think the American administration in Iraq would often make the comparison, electricity is back to what it was before the invasion. Mm. That was their comparison. That was kind of their measuring stick. That wasn't the measuring stick that most Iraqis were using. They were using, their comparison was to the 1970s. Was to this period. You know, it wasn't that we were going to get back to what we had under Saddam. It was going to be that we were going to get back to what we had maybe a generation earlier, when Iraq really was about to enter the first world in a way, enter the modern world, and stake its claim as a leader of that region, at least.
Well, you were reporting before the occupation, invasion, war, whatever we call it, and I wanted to ask you to talk a bit about the range of views of the people that you were in touch with before the invasion. Obviously, you found a range of views, but some were more hopeful, and everyone seemed to have some expectations about what America would do.
You know, before the invasion itself, just if I can add a kind of a, there's something that really struck me in reporting often, and that's, I think, you know, there's such a notion, I think, in this country that we take over Iraq in a way. We help build a new country, a country that's going to serve as a beacon to the rest of the region. And I think we never appreciated at a certain level what Iraq had gone through after this period of the 1970s. I mean, you know, it's breathtaking in a way. I mean, you know, for me as a reporter to look back at this as more recent history, a decade of 8 years of war with Iran in the 1980s that left a million dead and wounded on both sides. And 1990s was, you know, began with another war, was followed by decade of sanctions that basically wiped out the middle class and crippled the infrastructure there. And then, of course, there was Saddam's tyranny over this period. I mean, it's kind of breathtaking to see the scars that were left from this 20-year period. The country was brutalized, it was traumatized, and the country that we inherited was not a blank slate. It was a country with a lot of grievances, resentments, frustrations, and hopes. And like you pointed out, there were a range of opinions before the invasion. I didn't hear the word liberation used all that often before the invasion. Now, was that because Saddam was still in power and you couldn't speak freely? I think that was part of it. But I also think there was a deep sense of fear and of anxiety about what was going to be ahead. I mean, I think Iraqis knew very well that looting would follow Saddam's fall. I mean, there was a run on gun stores mm-hmm. in those weeks before American tanks ever entered Iraq. They weren't buying guns to defend themselves against the Americans. They were buying guns to defend themselves against each other. I mean, I think people were very conscious of what was ahead. And it also kind of explains, I guess, if you take a look at it from a little bit different perspective, it explains this kind of tortured relationship with the United States, I think, at a certain level. I mean, I think it was often cast here that it was Saddam against his people and that we were against Saddam. And I guess what struck me, in talking to people and going through my own process of trying to understand the region, was that it was often cast in terms of Saddam and the United States against the Iraqi people. What I mean by that, it's people look to U.S. support for Saddam in the 1980s in the war against Iran. They looked at the U.S. role in keeping sanctions in place. Religious Shiites remembered that the U.S. abandoned the uprising, mm-hmm. the Shiite uprising against Saddam that followed the 1991 Gulf War. I mean, it was a very complicated relationship, and there was a lot of baggage there. And, the Americans, they didn't just enter as liberators. They entered with this 20-year history that complicated the picture.
Yeah. Well, let me just mention again, we're talking this morning with Anthony Shadid. He's a reporter for the Washington Post. We're talking about his book, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War. You can join our conversation by calling us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Some of the people you spoke with, there was a doctor, Fuad Musa Muhammad, who essentially was very skeptical, and there was another Sunni former diplomat, Farak Zaida, if I'm not mangling the pronunciation of his name, who was more optimistic. And in fact, Farak was almost gleeful at the idea of liberation from Saddam. And whereas Fawad was, I think, more of the view, if they're liberators, great, but if they're occupiers, then, there's going to be trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, there were such interesting men. I met both of them during the invasion. It was actually Fuad who was the one that was most optimistic. And I remember walking into his house. I mean, this is the very end of the invasion. And the end of the invasion was pretty bloody. They were sitting in his apartment. The electricity had gone out by that point, and he was sitting in the dark. You could hear the thunder of artillery outside, and he was just smiling. He was just, he was anticipating the moment. He was ready for Saddam to be done with. He was ready for the Americans to arrive. And he was, in a lot of ways, the person, I think, the kind of Iraqi that most Americans would hope to meet in Iraq. He thought this was going to be a return to what he had a long time ago, to what he had 20, 30 years ago. And as you mentioned, Fuad was the opposite. I sat with him and his family having lunch during the invasion. And that conversation was much different. And it also kind of hinted to me that there was a lot more gray there than black and white about the invasion, about the fall of Saddam. Fuad was very blunt. He hated Saddam. He thought Saddam had caused all kinds of catastrophes for the country, but that didn't mean that he was going to welcome the Americans. That didn't mean he wanted to have his country occupied. And what was so interesting about these two men is that they did start out at such different points. I mean, they really didn't see eye to eye at all on this stuff. But as the year passed, and as the months passed, and as things didn't get better, as there were still problems with electricity, as the insurgency began, as crime, was rampant still in the streets of Baghdad, they began to intersect in their opinions. And it reached a point, I remember last year when I was talking to Fuad, and he said something to me. He said, because in these times of trouble, people have short memories. And I'm not quoting it exactly, but it's something along those lines. People tend to forget. And then I went over to Fuad's house soon after, and he almost said the exact same thing to me. And that really struck me. I mean, I think it sounds kind of obvious to us, that people tend to forget. But what it said to me, I guess, as a reporter and somebody trying to make sense of it all, was that, it wasn't about Saddam anymore. It was about what they had today in Iraq, and that these challenges of daily life had become so overwhelming, had become suffocating in a way that it kind of obliterated everything else that was going on.
Well, and see, I got the two confused already, so maybe that sort of illustrates our problem in understanding.
They're similar names, so that's...
Right. Well, we do have a call to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. This is someone in Charleston on line number four. Good morning.
Thank you very much. Something you said earlier about the perspective of your book versus other ones, especially the embedded reporters and so on, something about looking at things not from the standpoint of those people dropping the bombs, but the people on whom the bombs were falling. I'd heard something similar to use to describe the perspective of Al Jazeera for the Arabic-speaking world versus what the rest of it is. Is there any way you could meaningfully compare your perspective with something similar to what Al Jazeera does in terms of what you wanted it to do?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Al Jazeera is so important, and Latabi, I think, is important as well. The two main Arabic satellite channels, and I admire the reporters in a lot of ways. I think they're very brave reporters in Iraq, and they do work that I think sometimes we're reluctant to do, which is, you know, go with a camera inside Fallujah sometimes, and a lot of them have been killed because of that. And so I do have a lot of admiration for them. You know, if we talk about the kind of style of reporting or the approach to the reporting, it's hard for me to compare what I was trying to do and what they were doing just because the audiences are so different. I mean, I was very much writing for an American audience, and Al Jazeera is not. It's very much broadcasting for an Arab audience. You know, the only thing that kind of just strikes me as a little bit, well, this isn't a similarity. I guess it's more that, you know, Al Jazeera does have this ambition to put forth another perspective. I mean, that's almost its reason for being, is to put forth a perspective that might not be there in the Western media. You know, if you can say that what I was trying to write about was a different perspective or a perspective that wasn't out there, I guess in that sense there might be kind of a similarity. But, you know, I think the audience probably dictates the differences more, and that the audiences are so vastly different that while some things about the style of reporting might be similar, the stories that actually result, or the product itself, is just, it is vastly different.
Does that get your question?
That's fine. Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay, thanks so much for the call. Another caller, line number one, someone in Champaign County next. Good morning.
Hi. Did you know the fellow, I think this was covered on The World yesterday, the guy that was featured in Control Room, who was a military correspondent, has gone to work for Al Jazeera English language?
Yeah, I saw that. I don't know him. I saw Control Room, mm-hmm. I saw the documentary, so I was familiar with what he was doing, and I had heard that he was working for Al Jazeera. Now, I think it's going to be an interesting project, Al Jazeera in English. I'm be interested to see what, you know, what kind of reception it gets.
Right.
Yeah.
I heard you on a couple other shows, and you didn't use the bit of Arabic that sort of swagger like a Baghdadi, walk like an Egyptian or something. I think that's salient, actually, that to show where Baghdad, how it features in the Arab mind. And it went from being a medical center to being, you know, a case where they didn't even have aspirin, right?
You know, there was, like you pointed out, there is a word in Arabic, Baghdada, which means to, in a way, to swagger, kind of show off, to, you know. And it's a word that's drawn from the name of the city, the idea of what the city once was. And again, you know, I think when we talk about Baghdad and what it means to the Arab world, or what it means, you know, to the Muslim world for that matter, it is, you know, like I said, it is more an idea than a reality. And I think that idea remains powerful in a way. And I think, you know, it's not, you know, I remember a friend of mine, an Egyptian friend, who was rooming with me during the invasion, and he said, you know, when we were talking about the fall of Saddam and how he felt about it, and it wasn't, you know, anger, it wasn't joy. It was more kind of regret in a way, you know, and it wasn't that, I guess it wasn't that, you know, Riyadh had fallen, or Doha, or these cities that are much more modern, much more recent. It was that Baghdad had fallen, and, you know, a city was conquered in the name of its liberation, but a conquest is a conquest, and, you know, in a city of such kind of such history, of such resonance, it does make you pause.
I wanted to applaud your idea of looking at the history, particularly from the Arab mind, and particularly the Iraqis. You know, it's somehow easy for Americans to forget that, you know, we were using the Iran-Iraq battle, shipping arms to one side secretly and giving intelligence targeting information to the other side, and we're playing them off. You know, the famous expression by Kissinger when they cut off the Kurds for maybe the second time, don't confuse covert action with missionary work, when thousands of Kurds died because they were no longer needed to bleed. Was it Iraq or Iran that time? I can't remember.
They had struck a deal, right?
Right. 73 over Shah al-Arab.
Exactly.
People in this country just don't have any sense of that, but a lot of Iraqis know. I mean, it's a youthful population, so many maybe don't know. But I don't know what to make of it. It seems to me that it's interesting to note that a satiric comedy show in America, Arrested Development, featured the image of Rumsfeld shaking Saddam's hand this past Monday. So.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the part of the plot line, you can cut me off because I certainly am digressing, but it certainly shows the history. Part of the plot line is the patriarch of the family was making a deal to build housing for Saddam to violate the sanctions, and they said something like, well, it's career ender to do that. And they said, well, not in all cases, and they flashed a picture of Rumsfeld on the screen shaking Saddam's hand. So, thank you. I'll leave on that note.
All right.
I think it's a good point, though, and I think this is something that the United States has such a difficulty. It's one of the reasons for the difficulty in Iraq is that, I mean, let's face it, when we look at policy over the past 20 or 30 years, there hasn't always been a lot of principle involved. And I think you make that point about the Iran-Iraq war, which is a good one. And I think a lot of Iraqis do think that Saddam wouldn't have lasted as long as he did without U.S. support in the war there. And so, you know, we're now talking about these principles of democracy, of liberation, of freedom, of individual rights. But there is a record that we have to take into account in the past. And I think, you know, Condoleezza Rice mentioned this record in an address in Cairo. She made this point that we had made mistakes in the past. We maybe didn't get our priorities straight. But that doesn't mean that the confusion, these conflicts, the contradictions are going to go away overnight. I mean, it still does shadow this perception of American intentions to a great degree, and especially in Iraq, a country that has, you know, whose history has often been steered by those policies.
Mm-hmm. There are so many great stories and insights in the book, and we're only going to be able to hit on some of the high points. One of the things I wanted to ask you to talk about is, you know, this whole issue of misperception, which I think pervades the entire story. And when we speak of we're bringing democracy to the Middle East, or, you know, the official rhetoric sort of defines how the spin has to make things look. So we get these snapshots that, you know, that say, well, you know, the Iraqis are going to greet us with roses, you know, at our feet and so forth. And so, you know, there have to be some pictures of that. But on the other hand, there are other pictures that don't get in the frame. Then you speak with people. There was one story you wrote about. You went on a patrol with one of your colleagues from the Washington Post. He was with the soldiers, the American soldiers on patrol, as they were patrolling very dangerous areas, I believe in Baghdad. And you were sort of, you know, trailing behind and speaking with people on the side. And the perceptions at the front of the line and from where you stood were very, very, very different.
You know, and I didn't even know what to make of that story. Tom Ricks, a colleague of mine at the Washington Post, a truly great journalist, had just come up to me the day before and said, you know, I've got an idea for a story. Why don't I go with the soldiers on a patrol through this neighborhood called Yarmouk, and then you follow behind and just see what people say, and let's see if we can, like, do kind of a, you know, a patrol from two different perspectives. And, you know, I said, why not? So we went out that day, and it was it was probably one of the most illuminating moments I think I had as a reporter in Iraq. And I wasn't hearing what the American soldiers were saying, but I was hearing very clearly what the Iraqis were saying as I followed behind. You know, there were people who saw this as a liberation. There's no question about that. And in that street that day, there were people who said, I'd rather have a dog rule this country than have Saddam rule it. There were people who saw the soldiers there as bringing a sense of security, especially in this aftermath of lawlessness and looting that had kind of wrecked the city. But I guess more often I heard an ambivalence and even an anger and a resentment that this was an occupation, and occupation means something different in English than it does in Arabic. There's just no question. I think occupation often suggests to us in English, Japan, and Germany after World War II, occupation, or ihtilal in Arabic, means something very different. And it's often suggests Israel and Palestine, or it suggests the British in Iraq after World War I. And this one guy standing there telling me it was hot outside, the sun was just unrelenting, and he said, I feel like they're walking over my heart. I feel like they're crushing my heart. And, you know, that really struck me right there, that, you know, how gray this was. It wasn't black and white. It was very gray. And it was a sense, this is right at the very beginning of the insurgency, but it was a sense of how sentiments could build toward, you know, more violent campaign against the presence of the U.S. military there.
And the soldier was telling your colleague, "These people love us.
They love us. 90% of them love us." That was the, and it was a weird moment. I didn't actually describe the put this all that much in the book, but you know, it was because those soldiers were well intentioned. You know, they believed what they were doing, and they were principled. I mean, I didn't doubt their intentions. And we got together with them afterwards, Tom and I did, and we were talking to them, and they wanted to know what I had heard, and I told them. And it was one of those moments where, you know, you can almost see that their feelings were hurt, that they didn't understand that. And, you know, and I think most of them didn't believe me either, but it was one of those, you know, you just felt, it struck you so clearly how so often in Iraq two languages are being spoken. And obviously it's English and Arabic, but, you know, at a deeper level, there's two sets of vocabularies, two sets of ideas, two sets of memories, of histories. Of it goes on and on. And, you know, often they don't intersect. Often they actually collide.
We're a little past our midpoint during this hour of Focus 580 with Anthony Shadid. He won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his reporting from Iraq, and he's the author of the book we're discussing, Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, published just recently by Henry Holt. And we welcome your questions if you'd like to join us. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to also talk with you about the reactions to American attempts to put down the resistance. Unfortunately, innocent people come into the line of fire, and in many cases, houses are raided by troops looking for insurgents. And in the process, you know, many people are, you know, essentially see this. Well, at least many Iraqi people who are essentially having their doors, you know, knocked down by troops as humiliation, whereas the American military undoubtedly saw it and sees it as necessary from a security standpoint.
Right, and I think that's, you know, that's, again, that's one of those things where you almost, certain things feel inevitable in a way about how that unfolds. You know, that there is just a certain relationship of power, of those with power and those without power, and that friction and tension and conflict arises out of that. I mean, you know, time and again, I remember this, especially in 2003 when we could report in the with a lot of freedom, actually, kind of almost, you know, unencumbered. We could report, you know, unencumbered in these towns in western Iraq, the most conservative and traditional towns of the country that were, you know, populated by Sunni Arabs who, from where the insurgency is predominantly drawn. And it was these tiny slights that turned into huge grievances, that turned into provocations, that turned into, you know, vendettas that lasted months and months and months. And, you know, I don't know. It's, I remember going to this one village of Heat, and it was probably the first spontaneous uprising had occurred against the presence of U.S. troops. And, you know, the provocations were things that we wouldn't even probably have, you know, they thought the helicopters were spying on them as they slept on the roof. That soldiers would enter the rooms of women without the men present. They'd confiscate guns that every Iraqi felt he was entitled to. You know, they're not in themselves are not huge things, but they did become big, and then they were reflected through this lens that we've been talking about a little bit. This lens of mistrust and of a little bit of confusion and not clear what the Americans are really up to. They grew fiercer and fiercer until I think we had what we have today.
Our lines are full. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. We'll go next to someone in Monticello. Line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. This is just a general comment.
Mm-hmm.
It really has nothing to do with what you're saying, but it sort of does in a way. It's fact that we had all these problems with CNN saying that all these thousands of people were killed in the hurricane. And I have a real trouble now believing anything that the media has put on, anything about the war and the hurricanes and anything. And we've got this hate Bush mentality that anything is wrong is Bush's fault. And, you know, I'm really getting tired of all this, and I think we need to go back to where we're actually reporting facts. And, you know, again, I'm not saying that you're right or wrong or anything, but I'm just saying everybody in the media has a total credibility problem now. And, I mean, I don't know whether to believe you or not.
Yeah.
You know, and everything that you tell is subject to your interpretation out there. And I don't know, you know, what your slant is political. You know, you can be whatever you want to be, that's fine. But, you know, if you're not reporting the facts accurate or truthful, because you have, you know, some kind of problem with somebody. I mean, I don't know that, and I just get to the point where I just say, I don't believe you.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You know, I think it's, I think you should be critical of what we report. I don't have any problem with that. I think the more skepticism out there, the more, you know, you hear something, you're not sure if that's true, I'm going to check it out over here, you know. I think that's important. And I'm not going to claim truth is an elusive concept in Iraq these days. Let's face it. And when you say reporting the facts, you know, facts are often interpreted. Facts are often coming from different perspectives. And one fact is, you know, somebody else's slant. That's happened to me all the time as a reporter. I wouldn't claim that what I was doing in Iraq was the only thing that people should have read. The opposite. I mean, I think we should have, you know, as many perspectives out there as possible. I do think that the fact is a malleable term. And I think it's difficult to say that you could just report the facts in Iraq. What kind of facts are you going to report? Where are you going to report those facts? According to who are those facts going to come from? I mean, it becomes kind of confusing, but, you know, what I tried to do was understand what people were saying, and I tried to let them say it. You know, it wasn't my job to tell them what to say or to ask them the questions that would try to lead them in a certain direction. I just wanted to hear these conversations of what people said and then report it. You know, and I'd always try to make a point that this wasn't necessarily representative. It wasn't necessarily the thing that everybody was saying, but it is what these people are saying. And if we listen to these people, we at least know what's being said here at this time, at this moment, and at this place. And, you know, the more we listen, probably the better we understand what's going on.
I hope that helps that point. We'll go next to an Urbana listener, line number 2. Good morning.
Hey, thanks very much. I just wondered if you could comment on how the impact of the Abu Ghraib and the prisoner abuse scandals, what kind of reactions you heard to that, and more generally, the detaining of people and the conditions under which they're kept in Iraq. And
yeah.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
It's a good question. And, you know, this is going to be a weird answer probably, and I want to be careful how I put this. I think Abu Ghraib had a bigger impact in the Arab world in some ways than it did in Iraq. And what I mean by that is I think there's a lot of anger in the Arab world about U.S. policy. And I think what happened in Abu Ghraib kind of, you know, solidified people's opinions in much of the Arab world about what the Americans were up to. It kind of fit into this perception, and it added more, added more credence to this perception. In Iraq, it was a little bit different. I think the people who were mad and who knew that these bad things were going on, this is an example of it, and this is what the Americans are up to. And this is, you know, it's similar to the way it was seen in the rest of the Arab world. I think there was also a sense that, you know, there's been a long history of torture and mistreatment in Iraq, and, you know, Saddam did it, people before Saddam did it, and maybe there wasn't as much surprise about the torture itself, but that the Americans were in a long line of people who had mistreated people in that country. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, and it's not very black and white, but it was kind of a complicated reaction to it. Now, I think when you talk about the arrests, I'll tell you, that's an explosive issue, and it's probably having more of an... I know they intersect a little bit, but I think the arrests themselves are more important, perhaps, than what happened in Abu Ghraib. And I don't want to minimize what happened in Abu Ghraib. I'm just trying to say that it was sometimes a kind of a complicated reaction to it. But these arrests are huge, because often relatives of people will be arrested, kind of held as, you know, as what do you call it, ransom, or, you know,
yeah,
try to get somebody to turn themselves in. They're often held without charge. People don't know where they're at. And we're talking about thousands of people. I mean, I think the number is 14,000, 15,000 people who are being held. And we were, you know, my colleague and I did a story about Camp Buka, the second biggest prison in southern Iraq. You know, and even the commandant there, the commander, the American commander, I think he acknowledged that 1 in 4 were probably innocent. 25% of the people there were probably innocent, which is, it's kind of spectacular when you think about it. When you think of the families of those innocent and the anger that creates, I mean, I think it is. It's a much bigger deal than we probably have properly explained as reporters.
Well, I'm glad the caller asked about Abu Ghraib, because the book ends before we get to that point, and the photos were revealed and so forth. There's so many other episodes that you cover in the book, but I'm sure your writing has continued on, obviously, and you're going back to Iraq, I believe, next week.
Right. I've been there most of the year. I spent some time in Egypt and Syria and the Gulf, but I am going back next week for the referendum.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can talk about that as well, but our lines are full, so I'm going to go on to another listener, line number 3 in Urbana. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. Local TV commentator on one of the television stations, Mark Hyman, says that stories about positive interaction between U.S. troops and the Iraqi people are being ignored by the three main broadcast networks and CNN. What is your comment on that assertion?
You know, that question has been asked a lot as I've been talking about the book, and I don't quite get it, to be honest. My job as a reporter is not to look at good news and bad news. It's to understand what's going on. And, you know, granted, you know, as politely as possible.
Oh, go ahead.
There's not a lot of good news right now. I think if we see what's going on in Iraq, it has been a steady deterioration. And there have been moments where I've seen things that have been going really well. Let me give you an example. In Sadr City, for instance, which is a sprawling, very poor neighborhood in Baghdad, 2 or 3 million people. The United States has put probably $300 million into that neighborhood, and it's remarkable. There are changes there. But here again is how it gets complicated. So if you ask people, and I did a story about this. I did a story about the work that was going into this neighborhood. And when you ask people in the neighborhood, who do you credit for this? They say, well, I credit the cleric.
Uh-huh.
I credit the mosque for helping fix the streets. And so it just gets so complicated at times. And, you know, I think there are projects going on. I think most of the money now is being diverted toward the security forces and toward fighting the insurgency. So you're seeing less reconstruction than you might have seen before. But I don't think that comes up in conversations that I have with Iraqis. Not one Iraqi, not one Iraqi I've talked to has mentioned a school being painted or something like that. And you know, maybe that's because they're not seeing it. Maybe that's not fair. Maybe I'm talking to the wrong people, and I freely acknowledge that. But it's just not something that has come up so much that I feel as a reporter I need to jump on it because it's shaping the country today.
Unlike that guy from Monticello, I trust what you say. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. And next up, someone on line number 4 in Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you spoke about this. I'm interested in what's happening in the southern portion in Basra. Two American reporters have been assassinated so far, Stephen Vincent and another gentleman with the New York Times. And it seems like even if we get, quote-unquote, our democracy, it might take the form of government that they have in the southern portion, which seems to be even more strict than in Iran even. And I don't see a lot of people talking about this in the news media, not about the assassinations of the two reporters or even the trouble that the British are having now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another thing I don't see people talking about is the fact that Mukhtar al-Sadr is against the federalization process, too. And no one seems to talk about what's going to happen if he joins with the Sunnis in defeating the constitution, the proposed constitution. So if you have any insight on that, how did the situation in the South develop that way? How did it become under the control of these militias and how? They seem to have infiltrated totally the police force.
Yeah, great questions. And in fact, if you get a chance, I don't know if it's still on the website or not, but a colleague of mine and I did a couple of pieces on this, on those very questions, in the past, I guess it would have been in August. I don't know if they're still on the website or not, but I did a piece on Sadr and his kind of rising influence, and also we did a very long piece about what was going on in southern Iraq and northern Iraq. I think you bring up a really important point of what's shaping Iraq today, and that is, Basra, you know, I was in Basra a few weeks ago, and it was the most scared I've ever been as a reporter in the past 2 or 3 years in Iraq, because you have a phenomenon there where the militias, I mean just basically armed men, loyal to Sadr, loyal to other Shiite parties, have infiltrated the security forces, where I think at this point it's safe to say a majority of the police are loyal to these parties. There's no accountability. They have their own agendas, and they're the people that are carrying out the assassinations. And I was so scared because, I mean, you walk in the street and you see a police officer, and you don't know if he's there to protect you or to kill you. And, you know, you asked why it happened this way. I think there was I hesitate to speak with too much authority on this because the British, or sometimes they don't talk about this all that much, but there was a beginning. In the beginning, they had to reconstitute the security forces, and they relied on the parties, the Islamic parties there, to reconstitute those forces. It was a short-term solution to the vacuum of authority that was going on there. Now we're starting to see the long-term implications of that, which is that the militias have the guns, and they're the only ones with the guns, and they're the ones, you know, Iraq is increasingly being ruled by, especially the South is being ruled by men with guns. I don't see it getting better, and I think it's maybe a little, I don't want to be bleak, but I think there is a little bit of an insight of what might be ahead here, and that is, you know, it's not necessarily a struggle or a conflict that pits Sunnis against Shiites, against Kurds, but it may be more militias rivalries within the communities, for instance, like rival Shiite militias battling for power in places like Basra, that increasingly shapes things in that region, at least, and maybe in other parts of the country.
I just have one more question, because you raised something about the British, which we already know is a problem with the United States. There was no plan once we got there.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, if there was no plan once they got there, why didn't they plan to get out very quickly? In fact, when the Iraqis wanted them to get out, which was about April, since they had no plan for any type of occupation.
Well, I think they did plan to get out early and then realized they couldn't. And that was, you know, part of the bad planning. I mean, the British were a little bit different than the Americans. The British were much less aggressive in a way than the Americans were in Iraq. And I think the British kind of, you know, hung back in Basra. They, you know, basically said, if you don't kill us, we're going to not get too much in the way. Now the place has become much more violent, as you pointed out. So, but I think you're right. I think you make the point that, we saw this. You know, I look back at the report. I remember the war. I look back to the aftermath. And I think this was often cast, the centerpiece of this entire thing was often cast as the fall of Saddam. We're going to overthrow Saddam's government. The centerpiece wasn't what followed. But I think what we've seen over the past 2 years is that, indeed, this is the centerpiece, the insurgency, the occupation. These issues that we're dealing with now are the centerpiece of this entire project. And part of me, and I may be wrong, and I'm really bad at predictions, but part of me worries that we're just seeing the preamble of something that is bigger. That's something that is taking shape that might be bigger than what we're seeing now.
Our lines remain full, and I want to get on to some more callers. But there's one thing that sort of jumps out as you look at what has happened over the past couple of years in Iraq with the insurgency, and it seems that the point of the insurgency is not to win militarily, because they really can't, but simply to dash America's hopes for success.
I think that's I had that insight. I mean, it struck me. Pardon me. That struck me as I was standing in Karbala in, I think it was February of 2004, and there was a series of suicide bombs that just, it was just unbelievable carnage. I think it was the worst carnage in Iraq to that point. And there have been worse episodes since then, but at that point I think it was the worst. And it just struck me that the only point of these attacks was to create a spectacle, and that the insurgents, that one current, at least a few, you know, some currents within the insurgency understood that the only way to defeat the Americans was to create this perception of failure. And you create a perception of failure through anarchy and chaos and disorder, through spectacles. And that's what these attacks have become, is spectacles. And to keep creating that spectacle, you have to keep killing more people and more people. You know, 20 people dead in a car bomb in 2003 was a banner headline in the Washington Post. And, you know, today it's a quiet day in Baghdad. And the spectacle keeps on growing, and people keep dying to create this spectacle.
Let's go on and talk with some more listeners. Next up, someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. It seems to me our idea of democracy is really one where we necessarily have to have corrupt media and corrupt elections, which kind of lead to rule by the rich, which leads to my question. Are Iraqis familiar with the idea that, like Jim Hightower would say, Congress is the best Congress money can buy? And what is the Iraqi attitude toward plutocracy, especially given the way Saddam chose to spend a lot of his wealth on these palatial estates?
Yeah, I think there is a lot of suspicion and kind of distrust about that. I mean, you know, corruption is rampant in Iraq these days, and it's often carried up by these parties that kind of return to Iraq after the fall of Saddam. And people know that. People talk about that a lot, that you can't get a job in the bureaucracy without a recommendation from the party. You can't get a job as a police officer without a recommendation from the party. And often those recommendations cost money. I think there is a kind of a disgust with the level of corruption. And, you know, let's face it, the government that's been constituted now doesn't have a lot of credibility. It's ineffective on one hand. And two, it's so riven by these divisions. And I think what a lot of people would describe as self-interest, that it doesn't make a big impression, I think, on most people's lives. But, you know, I can just add this real quick. I know there's a lot of callers, but, you know, I think we talk a lot about democracy, and it's not a big part of the conversation that I have in Iraq, at least. The bigger part of the conversation is how do you get through these challenges of everyday life, which are so overwhelming. You know, violence, lack of electricity, the carnage, the lack of water, lack of income. These things are so overwhelming that, you know, I may have already said this, but I mean, I think, you know, politics sometimes can become an indulgence.
We'll go on next to someone in Champaign, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. I have Arabic satellite stations, and the difference that I noticed in between the broadcasting, particularly with the fall of the Saddam Hussein statue, was that the American media would show it up close, and they would show the Iraqis rejoicing. But once I saw it on Al Jazeera in Arabia, they panned it out some, and yeah. You saw many more people crying. One elderly gentleman said that this was a sad day for Iraq, and it really showed just how different the broadcasting is for in the Arab media stations versus the American media stations. Which do you believe is the closest to the reality in terms of how the Iraqis view the war, the conflict that's going on? I'll hang up and just listen on the radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, I spent a lot of time working on that part of the book, actually. I mean, it's not it's a huge part of the book. It's the end of a chapter. It's the end of the invasion. But describing that scene, because I think, you know, it was a scene that was sometimes interpreted in different ways. And I think you're right. My biggest mistake as a reporter, I think it's, if you get a chance, I'd be curious your impression of how I portrayed it in the book, but I think as a reporter that day in Baghdad, I didn't make enough of a point of the size of the crowd, and I regret that. I think that was a mistake, because I think you're right, the crowd was not that big. And I think what I did get right, if I can say that, looking back on those stories, is that I captured the ambivalence that was there. There was jubilation. I mean, there was just no question. There was jubilation over Saddam's fall. He was unpopular. He was loathed by many people. There was relief about the war ending, that the invasion had ended, and people, you know, I think a lot of people thought, well, it's over. And I mean, of course, it's not over. It's still going on. But at that point, I think people were just relieved that they weren't going to die. And then what I felt powerfully that day, and I think what you kind of mentioned some of the images of that, was this ambivalence. You know, let's see what the Americans are going to do. You know, let's see what they're up to. I'm not sure what their intentions exactly are. And then also that ambivalence over the prospect of an occupation. And people felt that. I mean, it's a proud country. You know, people, and, you know, I don't think anybody, you know, what I often heard, in fact, maybe not on that day, but I think it was in the days that followed, was, and especially in the months that followed, was this desire on the part of Iraqis that they had liberated themselves, that they themselves had overthrown Saddam instead of a foreign army coming in to do it.
We have just about 3 minutes left. I'm going to try to squeeze in at least one more caller, line number 3 in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was just, when you were remarking about doors being broken down and guns being taken away and people being thrown into jail and no just cause, a lot of innocent people in jail, well, I just why is it so hard for Americans to understand what this does to a person and a society? If they just would think, well, how would you feel if this was happening in this country?
Yeah.
Why is it so difficult for Americans to understand that? It's on just a basic human level. I just don't get it.
Yeah, if I can just take a moment, I tell you, it's interesting. I've spent so much time in Baghdad, so it's kind of strange for me sometimes to come back to the United States and to hear the debate here, you know, rather than just kind of seeing it up close there. And I, you know what I am struck by, and I, you know, I'll probably speak more as an individual than as a reporter here, but it is this kind of desire among a lot of people to make what they're seeing fit what they already believe. And I don't quite understand that, because it's, you know, as a reporter, you try to just, you see it and try to appreciate and understand it. You've got to be very careful about not letting your proof, you know, not trying to make things fit into what you already believe. But I do notice that probably more than I remember in the past, that as people see things, they try to make them fit, and they often don't fit. And I think that's what Iraq is all about, is that, like I said earlier, it's not black and white. It's very gray. So that's kind of an aside. I don't think that answers your question. But
Well, I think it's all we can really expect. We literally have about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left, and the constitutional referendum is coming up in about 2 weeks. I know you don't probably want to make any predictions, but I guess I'm wondering, you know, what your take is on the importance of this moment and you know, for the coming years in Iraq.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't know what to expect. I don't. I think it's probably going to be seen more as a marker than as a turning point. Is, in other words, it's going to show the deepening, the hardening of lines between the sects and ethnicities in Iraq, rather than a way forward to a more stable Iraq. I guess that's just my sense.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, and there's much more that we certainly could talk about because the book is full of just fascinating stories. The book is Night Draws Near, Iraq's People in the Shadow of America's War, recently published by Henry Holt, and the author has been our guest, Anthony Shadid, Shadid, who is the reporter for The Washington Post and who won the Pulitzer Prize last year for his reporting from Iraq. Anthony Shadid, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.